Hi, I'm not a doctor, but I play one on TV. How much does it take to establish credibility when you talk about health, when you talk about science? And if you're not a doctor, why are you giving me advice? And why am I listening to you? And the thing is, psychologically, you know, marketeers know that even if you know that guy's really an actor, and we're talking about everybody from Buddy Ebsen, Marcus Welby days, all the way to Hugh Laurie and House MD, is that it's chronic that people, fans, walk up to these individuals, these actors, they know that they're actors, but they still ask them medical questions. At the height of its popularity, MASH star Alan Alda was actually invited to the Harvard Medical School to offer the commencement address, and he accepted. And I've got a transcript. It's a wonderful speech that he gave concerning, you know, being, you know, not just knowing your stuff, but treating people the way you ought to treat people. So it's good that he wasn't offering any medical advice in that instance, but it follows as far as the credence, as far as, you know, sometimes we'll just kind of accept whatever. And what I'd like for you to take away from the presentation today, and I don't even have the screen up yet, I'm told that it will work, yes, is that I want you to know these issues. And I'm going to try and weave Scripture in as I can, because it's always a little disconcerting to me, whether I'm wearing a lab coat or not, where I'm offering a lesson where Scripture is not involved. But some of these issues are going to be a little bit off the page that we're going to be talking about today. But I want to make certain that you know the issues. And Rick mentioned this morning, whenever we're talking to our young people, just educate ourselves on the issues so that we can share what we perceive the truth to be. Because the truth is not always that easily attained, especially when you're talking about medical and scientific issues. And let me give you three examples here real quick before we start in. There was an important study that was conducted back in 1990. It was published in JAMA, the Journal of the American Medical Association, in 1990. And this is what it revealed. An important study by Dr. Harlan Krumholtz revealed that persons with low cholesterol levels over the age of 70, with low cholesterol, died twice as often from heart attacks as older persons with higher cholesterol levels. And they've got the figures in here as far as above 130 milligrams per deciliter, I think, and under 130 milligrams per deciliter. So it's quantified. But that isn't what you hear when your doctor keeps trying to prescribe statins to you whenever you go into the doctor's office. You're going to have scientific studies that prove one thing, and then you've got someone else on the other side of the issue cooking the numbers and cooking the studies to make it look like the other way. You can get studies. It's just like statistics. You can get studies to come out to say pretty much whatever you care to. This study was done before the statin rage, and because there was money to be made, I perceive. And again, you know, I'm not a huge conspirator theorist, generally speaking, but I am I'm one to question. Oftentimes, whenever somebody says something, it's like, well, let me check that out, you know, rather than just taking what you're saying as gospel, because so oftentimes people may just be genuinely misinformed. Let me give you an example of that. In the September issue of the AARP Bulletin, some of you may have that. I take that because I like to know what the older folks are talking about. Is that there was an article in here, Alzheimer's, a New Theory. And it says, new research appears to upend our current understanding of the causes of Alzheimer's disease and may lead to a whole new approach to finding a cure for the devastating dementia. You know what we've been medicating people for? We've been medicating people to try and break down plaques inside of the brain, which we perceive to be the evidence and or the aggressor in the dementia and the Alzheimer's disease. What they're now finding, potentially, in some of the research is that those plaques are the body's natural defense mechanism to try and isolate free-floating proteins that get up in the brain tissue, try and isolate those damaging proteins. And all this time now, we've been trying to break those plaques down so that those proteins can do an extra number on our brains. See, it's well-meaning stuff, I think, oftentimes, as far as the studies are concerned, and as far as individuals involved in medicine are concerned. But we need to make sure that we are buying into whatever decisions we're making as far as our health is concerned, and as far as science is concerned, to look at it with a biblical worldview, going both directions. Because, again, you know, we're not of this world anymore. You know, we're not of the kingdoms of this world, and we're not of the somatic, we're not here to just perpetuate our lives for 150, 200, you know, eternal life here on earth, which is what medicine would like to deliver for folks. And there's money to be made in that, as long as people think it's possible. And the thing is, it's not possible. And sometimes it's not healthy for us to try and continue to perpetuate our life. In this world. I don't even know when I started. I'll just go 20 minutes and I'll stop. So I want to be upfront with you. I am not a doctor, although I do recommend a colonoscopy every 3 or 5 years if you're over the age of 50, until I become 50, and then I'll bump it up to 60. And I don't want to pretend even that I'm completely objective or unbiased, because I do believe that these things that we're talking about have to be screened through a biblical world viewpoint. There's just no other way. God wouldn't have it any other way, because God's revealed what His will is. And as much as we can, sometimes our science outstrips our ability to deal with some of the ethical issues, end-of-life issues, for example, that become very, very difficult for us to deal with. If you can mechanically keep somebody's body going, it's very tempting to want to keep doing that, hoping that some miracle will occur or will happen. When that science wasn't around, we had to accept the fact that we're all going to die. Whether we keep that body still going for another 5 days or 5 weeks or 15 years, we all are going to have to die. And I want you to know that the truth about medicine and science is not as dramatic or definitive as some might like to make it. You've got to take this drug or you're going to die. That's overly dramatic. In many cases, that's not you're not just going to immediately fall over when you walk out of the doctor's office. And there are certain precautions that we can take naturally and otherwise. My father-in-law, we're talking about statins. He tried a couple, three different ones, and he was getting leg pain and all the bad stuff that is a precursor for something really bad happening. And he finally just decided, you know what, I'm just going to take my chances. The same thing with aspirin, for example, not in his particular case, because he's taking 81 milligram aspirin. Did anyone here get recommended to them several years ago a 325 milligram, an adult aspirin a day? Anybody? You're not getting that advice anymore. It's a baby aspirin. It's 81 milligrams. Do you know why that is? Because they won't tell you this. Is that people were having strokes because their blood was getting too thin. And so the medical establishment decided, we can't be thinning their blood so much. And the blood has to be thinned sometimes under certain circumstances to make the blood flow easier. But the thing is that you're not going to hear about that. You're not going to hear about that. And so sometimes we're honest in medicine. Sometimes we just don't give you the reason why that the truth changes. Another thing in Isaiah chapter 55, it's very well established in my mind and anyone that believes in God, is that God's thoughts and ways are higher than our thoughts and our ways. And a lot of these things, a lot of the scientific issues, a lot of the medical issues are just beyond our finding out until God sees fit to reveal those truths to us. So until then, a lot of times we're just left guessing. We're left prognosticating about what is right and what's the right health direction to go. All right. I've been asked to address several specific issues. This is one of my favorite pictures of Rachel's hands and Avrin's feet. I've been asked to speak about abortion, and Bob thought that that was like a lesion or a sore on the pregnant woman's body. That's a baby's foot right there. Just for your information, that you're actually seeing the baby's foot through the abdominal wall of a mother. There's something going on there. And if anyone, or if you're discussing abortion with anyone, and they seem to think that, you know, abortion's okay, you know, early, mid, late term, it's okay, I highly recommend, because I Google imaged abortion. And if anybody thinks that that's okay, I highly recommend that you Google image abortion and see what comes up first on your screen. It is atrocious. And I kept trying to pan down for something that wouldn't just be absolutely incendiary to try and put up on a screen for a public display, and I couldn't find one. And so I was left with some of the soft sell here, which I'm fine with, but just the same. By best estimates, and again, everything has to be estimated, everything's a guess, because we don't know what's going on over in deep Africa. You know, you get these world statistical extrapolations, and there's no real way to be able to found them completely. But by best estimates, about a third of all conceptions end in abortion. And the majority of those are not elective. The majority of those occur by the embryo's failure to attach to the inside of the womb. And the other one is due to miscarriage after it has been able to attach. The child has been able to attach, but for one reason or another, the mother's body expels it in an untimely fashion. Those are referred to as spontaneous or naturally occurring abortions. But there are others, however, which are very unnatural. And a couple of them are pre-implantation type elective abortions. One are IUDs, intrauterine devices, which basically just agitates the inner lining of the uterus and will not allow that environment. In that environment, the child that would implant itself on the inside of the uterus is not allowed to, because the environment is inflamed, so the woman winds up expelling the child before the child has an opportunity to attach. Another one, which you hear about in the press now and again, and again just recently, the morning after pill. The morning after pill, again, doesn't prevent conception. What it does is it prevents the conceived zygote and resulting embryo from implanting itself on the inside of the mother's uterus pharmaceutically. And so what you're basically doing is, instead of preventing conception, it's actually already happened, and you're just getting rid of it before anybody's the wiser for it. After that, you have early, mid, late-term abortions. The early is up to 10 weeks. And then after 10 weeks, it's the fetus, which is the midsection from about 10 weeks to whatever a child can be sustained at. And right now, roughly, I don't know if there's any new information on it or not, children about 27 weeks, which is more or less past halfway, can be sustained outside of the womb, and can actually be brought along, and they can actually become healthy, and they can actually become productive members of society, which is the hallmark of what a person really is in this society, in this culture. Then you have late-term abortion, which is right up to birth, and then you've got partial birth, and then you've got post-term abortion, which is actually where the child's actually been delivered, and then the child is put to death then. Because it's elected to do so. God offers more than a soft commentary on the behavior of a society that would regard elective abortion as a reasonable solution to its sexual revolution or its sexual culture. And I do want to take a peek at Leviticus chapter 18. And in this entire chapter, it's all about sexual behavior, deviant sexual behavior, behavior that individuals should not undertake or involve themselves with if they're going to be following the law of God. And you go all through this chapter, and then all of a sudden, verse 20, do not have sexual relations with your neighbor's wife and defile yourself with her. All of a sudden, you have in verse 21, do not give any of your children to be sacrificed to Molech. for you must not profane the name of your God. I am the Lord. And then it continues on. All of the sexual behaviors previous to this are behaviors that might lead to conception. And then after this, it's sexual behaviors that might not lead to conception. Bestiality, homosexual relations, and like that. What we can tell from this passage is that it was the practice of some of the Canaanite peoples, I think it was the Amorites, I'm not sure, somebody can correct me on it, but it was part of their service so that they could continue in their sexual culture, is that you can't very well, if you've got the responsibility of a child, stay out all hours of the night or do whatever you want, whenever you want to do it. And that was one of the ways. And that, with elective abortion as it stands, that's pretty much what it is that we don't want our lifestyle to be altered by this thing, this organism that mistakenly is growing in the woman when behaviors weren't the way behaviors should have been. Continuing on in Leviticus chapter 18, it talks about, and this kind of ties in a little more with the science on down the line, is that God's creation doesn't appreciate its being defiled either. It said of those Canaanite peoples that their behavior was such, that behavior was such, that the land itself vomited them out. It actually had a reaction. And we see this with Abel's blood. God, whenever he's speaking to Cain, he says to Cain, yeah, you've been a farmer all these years, but however old he was, I don't think that he was all that old. But, you know, for as long as he was a farmer. He says, because the earth has opened up her mouth and received your brother's blood, it will no longer render you crop. That's one of the reasons why he was a vagrant and a wanderer, is because of the earth's reaction to his sin. The flood, because there was so much violence, we heard just this morning, because there was so much violence, the earth could not withstand it anymore, and God actually offered it peace. The name Noah means peace. And so God sent Noah in his ark to give the earth peace. Korah, Dathan, and Abiram went down with their tents and all of their families. Why? How? When? When the earth opened up her mouth and swallowed them and then closed it as if it was a regular orifice for the earth to have. I truly believe that there is a consciousness, and I want to be careful because I only have however much time I've got and I can only say what I need to say in however much time I've got to say it. But I truly believe that this creation, we're told in Romans chapter 8, is creation groans as if in birth pangs, such that the righteousness of God can be demonstrated on the created surface by Christ and His church. So I think that, you know, if we're going to talk about global warming, if we're going to talk about a hostile environment as far as the earth is concerned, I truly don't believe that it's carbon emissions that we should be discussing. I think it's sin commissions and sinful omissions is what we should really be discussing, as opposed to anything that might be naturally or man-made, created, going on in the earth. I really believe that it's a spiritual thing that's being manifested in the physical world. Embryonic stem cell transplants. And this cartoon, I'm still not quite sure if I get what the cartoonist was meaning whenever he delivered this cartoon. But it reads, I died waiting for embryonic stem cell research to find a cure. What about you? And you have a child here, and the cartoonist is obviously acknowledging that the embryo is a person, so I take that away. And the child says, well, I was the embryo. I really don't know what to take from that. What it does demonstrate, however, is the debate between using embryonic stem cells. How do we get those embryonic stem cells? Through fertility clinics. People go into fertility clinics, they can't have children, and because it's not cost effective to just take one egg and one sperm, because again, it's just a guess on whether that sperm is good or not, more than the egg. I think most of the eggs, relatively speaking, to the sperm are viable. But scientists have found out that sperms, not all sperms, are fertilizing sperms. Sometimes they're accompaniers, where they'll actually swim in front of the actual fertilizing sperm. Sometimes they'll do blocking. Sometimes they'll actually try and perform other functions inside the womb in order to kind of grease the wheels, if you will, allowing conception to actually take place. And so it's not cost effective to guess wrong on the one. So what winds up happening is the fertility specialist, they give the woman — I've got a slide later on here about something else, which I'll probably wind up blowing right through because I'm running out of time — is that they give the woman fertility drugs. She produces eggs. They take more than the one normal egg that a woman would produce in a month. They may yield 6, 8, 10, however many eggs, depending on what the drug is and the woman's response to it. Take it, put it in a dish, take the husband's sperm, inject it in, and see which ones are going to grow. If they all grow, you're not going to put 10 embryos in a woman's womb, generally speaking. Octomom notwithstanding. See, we created that problem for her. We created that problem for our society. We're just like, well, what was she thinking? What was she thinking trying to take 8 children to term? What are we thinking putting her in that position? And that's what it winds up being, is that you wind up putting in, generally it's about 3, 4, 5 eggs that are fertilized. You put it back into the womb, and the specialist, the health specialist, hope and pray that some of them die. They hope and pray that some of them die. Because a woman's body is not equipped to handle 8 children routinely. It just isn't designed to happen. And so what happens to the rest of those embryos? Well, they're put in the deep freeze. And there's freezers and freezers and freezers full of already conceived people in suspended animation in fertility clinics all over the country and all over the world, arguably, where the question's left, what do we do with them? What do we do with them? Do we destroy them without experimentation? Do we destroy them by our experimentation? And depending on how we answer that question, where does it stop? Well, should we let the embryos grow an extra long time so that we can yield more of their cells? Should we let them actually grow into a fetus so we can actually take some of the specialized organ and tissue cells that we might be able to hopefully transplant into other people on down the line? It just keeps going on and on and on until, you know, where does it stop? One of the things that I do want to — this is what an embryo looks like. And this is one of the payoffs for me actually doing the PowerPoint, because this is painful for me, having to be tied to something. But this, the larger circle is the embryo. And by my count, I was able to count 8 cells. 8 cells in there. And every one of those 8 cells is what's referred to as a stem cell. Stem cell, as far as the explanation of a stem cell, is it's kind of like a wild card cell that can be grafted in like a stem on a tree to become a productive member of a tissue or organ in the body. And so any one of these cells here could be taken out, and could be — any one of those could grow into a brain, into brain cells. Any one of those could grow into a heart cell. And into the heart organ, per se. When you're only looking at 8 cells, you know, where you know, there's going to be a brain and a heart, maybe even come out of one of those cells both. It's one of these things where, you know, they just want to test them. They just want to experiment. They just want to try a few things. And that's how science is, and that's how the scientists are treating the stem cell issue. And as far as we're concerned, as far as what it means to us, I don't believe it's right. I believe it's sinful, but anything that I could possibly do, certainly in the context of the lessons that we've heard this morning, there's very little that we can do about this. We can vote it as a factor in deciding who we're voting for, perhaps, as far as candidates are concerned, but the thing is that the only thing that the candidates are willing to commit to is whether federal funds are being used or not. So it winds up becoming a political football as opposed to, is it going to happen or not? It's happening all the time. It's happening with private funds. So if we think by voting for one candidate or another that we're going to stop stem cell research, we're mistaken, because it's going on as we speak, and that's really not even part of the political discussion that's being bandied about. One thing is that embryos are not the only place you can find stem cells. This is a PET scan. I don't know how they isolated the radionuclei to the fat, brown fat cells, but let me try the... Ooh, didn't know that was going to happen. Sorry, Cal. All right, but this collar you see coming down from the neck on down and across the front, that's where the brown stem cell, that's where the brown fat cells are found. And in those brown fat cells, they have properties very much like stem cells that you might find in an embryo. There are some cases in my materials here, some studies where they've actually done some laboratory research where they've actually been able to grow from rat brown fat cells, heart muscle cells, and been able to improve certain mice and rats' health as a result of it. So when we're talking about stem cell research, it's not all the same necessarily. There are ways of getting some of this stuff without having to destroy human life. So don't be fooled by that. That's one of those issues that I'd like for you to know going forward, is that there's a difference between embryonic stem cell research and stem cell research. And we need to encourage the discussion and or the move to go in the brown fat cell direction rather than using the embryonic stem cells. Cloning humans, human cloning. It's interesting, this is a time cover from 1993. I don't remember what month it was. First laboratory duplication of a human embryo raises the question, where do we draw the line? Because we're not drawing it here, obviously. We're going to keep pushing on. And that's what the scientific community is about. It's not about really drawing the line. It's just about creating the sensational story, getting people all excited and whatnot. And interestingly enough, about 9 years later, we have another time cover story. Human cloning is closer than you think. That sounded vaguely familiar about 9 years ago. And you see, things will just continue going on like this where, oh, it's coming. Oh, it's coming. Oh, it's coming. And the thing is that until God's ready to reveal this, you know, what is God's will concerning many of these things? A lot of it is demonstrated in his inaction in revealing this wisdom to men, where men just continually get frustrated and frustrated and frustrated. And he may eventually relent and allow them to do the evil thing that they're looking to do. But when it comes to cloning, it's not necessarily the cloning itself, the issue. I want to discuss that here in just a second. This is what, and I'm sorry, Cal, if there's any resemblance to Cal Spencer here, I apologize. I just don't know what he was doing with the Norelco on the top of his head. I just don't get it. This is the image that we get a lot of times when we talk about cloning, a soulless zombie. And this is the concern, and this is the perpetuated thing many times as far as those that are concerned about cloning. But you all know clones. Did you know that there are already clones? They walk among us. In fact, we have two of them here today. Does anybody have any idea who I might be speaking about? Yeah, and not just fraternal twins, but identical twins. Bill and Bob. And Bill's like, whenever I told Bill, I said, do you mind if I talk about you a little bit? And he's like, no, but he was laughing. He said, I can just imagine Clayton, you know, later on coming up and saying, huh, did Eric say clones or clowns? But you see, God's already done it right. For whatever you think of Bill and Bob, I think God's done it right. Okay? Well, and what a clone is it is two individuals who have identical genetic makeup, identical DNA. That's all a clone is. All right, and so whenever we talk about human cloning, what we're talking about is we're talking about identical twins that are one generation removed. We're talking about an individual who is in vitro fertilized, and this is the diagram that we have right here. And this is a diagram explaining Dolly, the Scottish cloned sheep, several years ago. Does anybody know what happened to Dolly? She actually had to be put down. She was going to die, but she was in such excruciating pain. Why? Because she had all sorts of systemic issues and problems that even though she was born into the world, few of her systems actually operated the way they ought to. And she was going to die shortly, so instead of allowing her to die naturally, they decided to go ahead and euthanize her and try and preserve her in whatever state she was so that they could do further research on down the line. But you see, even when we do the thing, we don't even do it right, and we just keep trying, and we keep trying, we keep trying. What winds up happening is that an egg cell is taken from an adult sheep, from a human, from whatever you care to do, and then a cell from highly suggestible tissue is taken. A lot of times, and in this instance, it was an udder. That's one of the reasons why breast cancer is such a problem for women. It's highly suggestible tissue. Cancer, it can be manipulated, and it can undergo genetic changes more readily than other tissues of the body, many of the other tissues of the body. So what they do is they wind up taking an old cell from an already grown individual person, and you take the old nucleus, the old DNA, and you inject it into this yolk. Basically, with the egg, you take the yolk out and leave the white. Then, in the place of the yolk, you inject the DNA material, and then you shock it. That's the number one way for them to try and get this life process started. You shock it with electricity, and you see what happens. And nothing happened this time. So they do it again, and they shock it again. Nothing happened that time. And it's, I don't know how these people get paid. Just keep doing this over and over and over and over and over again. That's another issue that I wish I had time to talk about. But I don't. Human therapeutic cloning. This winds up being a problem to me. And the cloning issue to me is a problem for the same reason that the creation of embryos in the laboratory bothers me, is that you begin this process, and who truly are we to arrest the work of God in its beginnings? You know, in Jeremiah chapter 1, verse 5, you know, before I formed you in the womb, I knew you. That's a very definitive statement that God makes in regards to Jeremiah. And it's not just an accident of nature. It's not just something that happens in a natural way. Before I formed you in the womb, I knew you. And so that's why, and I think for a long time, God forestalled the revelation of being able to do it in the laboratory. I'm going to have to blow through here. This was about the designer babies. You know, you pick the eyes, you pick the nose, you pick the mouth, you pick the ears, and everything's just hunky-dory. But for the same reasons, there are just too many variables. There are just way too many variables for us to be able to know how to do this right without just shotgunning the issue. And again, this is what we do with genetic screening to try and determine, you know, whether we're going to have a boy or a girl. For example, if the woman's given fertility drugs, we've heard this story before, multiple eggs are produced, eggs are fertilized to produce the embryos, then the embryos are analyzed for genetic defects and tissue compatibility. Only the healthy embryos are injected in, and by whatever standard they use, it's an ambiguous standard as far as what healthy is connotated. Again, if you're looking for a boy and not a girl, that means that all of the girls are going to be sick. That's not the embryo that I want. And so then you decide and you choose on ending or suspending that individual's life and going ahead and carrying some others to term. And then what blows my mind with this screen in particular is that they try and justify the whole process by using a transfusion from the umbilical cord blood, which is something that any one of us could do with our children's umbilical cord blood. But it's almost like they're trying to make it okay. The whole process is okay. And hey, not only do you have a healthy baby, but you also have made another baby well. It's pandering. Elective surgery. We need to be very careful in judging elective surgeries. And again, I appreciate the lesson that was brought last night. in some of the comments today in regards to how we spend our money, what our attentions should be. Our attention should be on things above and not on the earth. But that's easy for me to say when I'm not the woman that has had the radical mastectomy, who might like to have a reconstruction of her breast, for example. You know, it's not a physical issue per se. You know, people can undergo radical mastectomies and it happens, you know, and there are women that choose not to have breast reconstructions, for example. But it becomes an emotional thing. Well, if it's then an emotional thing and not truly a physical thing, what about individuals who have undergone other traumas in their life that elective surgeries might help them get over the hump? I just want us to be careful about judging individuals, especially individuals from outside, because I think that it's very, very important for us to encourage one another, again, to keep this focus above and not below. In 1 Peter chapter 3, verses 1 through 5, we're told that we're not to, it's not merely with external adornment, or it's not with external adornment, that the women of old, made themselves beautiful. It was in submission to God's plan. It was in submission to their husbands in particular. It was a strengthening and a beauty of the inner man, Peter writes. And we always need to encourage one another to look towards that. But if individuals on the outside feel too harshly judged on matters that aren't even ours to judge, 1 Corinthians chapter 5, Paul says, what have we to do with judging outsiders? We need to be very careful how we come off in regards to some of these issues. You know, hair colorization. Is it just a matter of price? You know, if we color our hair, if we get some hair implant, you know, where is it okay to color your hair but not to somehow otherwise alter your appearance? How about dentistry? If you lose teeth, should you just gum it? Or do you bite the bullet once you get your dentures? Or do you go for dental implants? Post implants that are a lot more natural looking and would certainly probably feel a lot more natural. They wouldn't be removable. It would be more of a permanent fix. How about RK? Radiokeratotomy for your eyes. If you're near or now farsighted. In order to improve your eyesight so that you don't have to wear those clunky glasses. You know, unless you're a commercial airline pilot or in the military and you fly vehicles. You know, do you really need that? Do you have to have that? Let's be very careful on the judgment that we render. Again, while encouraging all of our attentions to be above and not below. Exploring the universe and seeking life elsewhere. I apologize. What's the payoff to scientists in looking for life elsewhere? Well, academics need grant money. And the only way to get grant money is to have a problem to solve. And so if you're destroying the one planet, two, you know, life elsewhere would, you're destroying the one planet that you're on. And so you're looking elsewhere, and not only are you looking elsewhere potentially for you to jet off to, you know, we still talk about going to Mars, you know, and whatnot. I don't know why. I mean, we've already ruined one planet with our sin and otherwise. But life elsewhere, this is one of the big payoffs. Life elsewhere, even if it's an amoeba, would prove and or shake the faith of many weak believers, prove that there's no God. And there's nothing special about the world that He created here. Oh, well, there's nothing special about here because life, we've found life out on this other planet. And so you talk about this God that's taken all this care and this attention to this ball in the middle of space, and you think it's so special. It's not so special. There's life out there. And if you give it billions and billions of years, it'll become what we are. The credibility of God's Word. And I don't know if on the website you want to make these. I don't know. If you want to make this available on the website with the audio files, I'm fine with it. It'd be helpful. Here are a few issues that God reveals in the Scriptures concerning science and the like. The hydrologic cycle, as far as the evaporation-precipitation cycle, it's found in numerous places in the Old Testament. The jet stream, which was only definitively discovered in World War I by World War I pilots who realized that their ground speed was a lot faster than their air speed. It's like, dude, I'm in some sort of wind tunnel here that's just pushing me along. They finally definitively figure this out, and God is very explicit in Solomon's writings in Ecclesiastes chapter 1 that the wind moves to the north and to the south, ever returning on its path. So it's in a circular path. It's going north and south, and it continues back to where it began. That's the jet streams. There's no other explanation for that. And you can try and twist some of these other things. Well, God's talking in metaphors about the circle of the earth and what have you like that. Whatever. Whatever. There's plenty of good, hard stuff in here. Another thing that's very interesting to me, the star constellations here at the bottom, exhibiting predicted behavior, the Pleiades, Orion, and Arcturus. The Pleiades, God, in that passage in Job, refers to gathering them together. For Orion, he talks about loosening the band or loosening the bands. And Arcturus, you know, who set up the rules for him? I did. Pleiades, it's being observed astronomically that Pleiades, I think it's a group of 27 stars. I wish I could thumb through here. But they're all moving in the generally in the same direction at the same speed. And so they are actually, it's like a flock of birds, it's been described as, Pleiades. And so God in Job talks about gathering them together. Orion, loosening the band, loosening the bands of Orion, the three trademark stars in his belt, they're all three moving in different directions at different speeds, and they will eventually, two will wind up becoming one, and the third will wind up starting to float off in some other direction. There's evidence already in Job that God's already told us that that's going to happen. Arcturus is a sun that is, it's a star, but stars are suns. It's a sun that is roughly 40 times the mass of our sun. It's moving at 40 times the speed of our sun, and it's several times larger than our sun. And it's so large and it's moving so fast that it's not being manipulated by the gravitational force as apparently in the rest of the cosmos. Everything else is tied together, except for bodies like Arcturus. And Arcturus is one of those bodies. And we were told that he doesn't play by the rules that all the others play by. God was the one to set him up on that. I'm just going to quit. As far as the destruction of the firmament at the flood was so key to the changing of our environment. I just don't think we can fully appreciate. This is one evidence that we can see in the genealogies before the flood and after the flood. The average age before, and if you were to throw out Lamech and Enoch who walked with God, if Enoch hadn't walked with God and been taken by God at 365 years, this would jump up into the 900s of the average age. But immediately after the flood and on down, the next 10 generations, the average drops to 317. And you see it drop even further when David talks about the 70, and if by strength 80, an individual should live. We're now on a slow burn. Whether the earth is in a long way or short way heating up or cooling off, and there's the debate rages. Some of them think it's going to heat up, it's going to change the ocean currents, it makes it cool down. Whatever. We're being kept for destruction as far as this world is concerned. 1 Peter chapter 3 is very plain about that. 1 Peter chapter 3 is very plain about the scoffers and the naysayers, you know, even denying that God had a hand in the creation and that, you know, they say, well, all things continue as they have always been. They don't. They don't and they haven't. Here's an example of material that you'll get from the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. Granted, it's about 21 years old now, this information. I hope they've gotten wiser over the last 21 years. There are no natural causes to global warming, according to this chart. There are no natural causes. You know, and volcanoes are one of the huge hydrocarbon emitters in the environment. What about the sun? If you've got global warming, why don't you take a look at the sun that is actually giving the heat? And the thing is that there are 11-year cycles, and I'm not going to get to the whiteboard here, but the whole ozone thing, it's bogus. We can talk about it afterward. it's created by ultraviolet radiation. The sun goes through cycles where it's emitting more ultraviolet radiation, which up in the stratosphere takes atmospheric oxygen, O2, and creates ozone, O3, by manipulating by the irradiation. And then, you know, once it goes wintertime, summertime, wintertime, summertime, in the winter you're going to have less, in the summertime you're going to have more. And during that 11-year cycle, where the sun is extra hot and then it kind of calms down, you're going to have more ozone in this year, and you're going to have less ozone in this year. And what they wind up doing is they wind up taking, as the baseline, ozone levels during peak solar activity years, and then they show you what it looks like 5.5 years later. We're losing all the ozone. Well, no, it's just a natural aberration that occurs seasonally. I wish I had more time. I want you to know that you are not on the weak end of the medical or scientific debate. You're on the strong end. And a lot of the discussion, a lot of the things that purportedly are true, they just keep changing and changing and changing. And the scientists and medical experts just hope nobody's paying attention. So I appreciate the time that was given and that I took. And we'll now have a song. Why don't we go ahead and stand up?